If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Anytime you can see sort of be like through two windows beyond, birds cannot really perceive, you know, that's when you'll get a bird strike. And so in this environment, that was super, super important.
I remember the first time I was on site and we went into one of their buildings and there was a bird kill at the door. And that was walking into the building, that was the experience of seeing that kind of set the tone. That cannot happen at this new building.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Matt Wallace, partner, and John Taylor, or JT, Schaffhauser, associate at Lake Flato Architects with offices in San Antonio and Austin, Texas, and right here in Portland, Oregon. John Taylor, known to many as JT, is deeply committed to responsible stewardship of the natural environment. As one of Lake Flato's certified Passive House consultants, he brings a wealth of technical expertise in high-performance design strategies to every project, including the firm's first certified Passive House project in Northern Illinois. Outside of his work at Lake Flato's Eco Conservation Studio, JT is dedicated to international humanitarian aid and development, frequently volunteering as an architect to design buildings for remote, underserved communities and NGOs worldwide. Matt Wallace is a co-leader of Lake Flato's Eco Conservation Studio, which fulfills his passion for championing projects that encourage environmental stewardship. Matt's work reflects an innate respect for the land, where architecture first considers the natural environment, then responds organically to its unique character of place. Design resilience and understanding how the environment can influence and create design synergies are the defining principles of his approach, allowing a process that values the indigenous ecosystem and each site's best assets. The project we're talking about today is the Ryerson Woods Education Center in Deerfield, Illinois. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Set lightly within the flatwoods bordering the Des Plaines River, the Ryerson Woods Education Center is less an object in the landscape than an extension of it, an architecture shaped by its surroundings and in dialogue with the systems it seeks to illuminate. But the project began as a site revitalization and removal of historic cabins that previously housed educational programming.
Lake County is an entity that's has really high sustainability standards. In fact, their Welcome Center, which is located on the same property, was one of the first in the state of Illinois to achieve platinum certification, I want to say in the late 90s, JT, maybe?
Early 2000s, yeah.
And they were looking for the next step. They knew, I think, they wanted a net zero, but they didn't know how, what certification. And so we kind of zeroed in on that. But they're just a great client with a similar vision as us. So it was a great fit.
So the Ryerson Education Center is an environmental learning center and really a trailhead within about 560-acre forest preserve. This is a really remarkable and wonderful thing about the Chicago metropolitan area. They have these public forest preserves and all of these public lands that are stewarded by the local governments there. And so this education center was constructed to replace some really old cabins at the end of their useful life that were hosting educational programming at this really important preserve. So this is a hub for programming for K-12 students, scout troops, public workshops, really a place for the community and broader metro area to come and connect to nature.
The Ryerson Education Center project was really filling a big void for us.
This is Becky Mathis, landscape architect for Lake County Forest Preserves.
So the Lake County Forest Preserve District provides education programmings throughout all of Lake County. We're the stewards of Lake County's history and our cultural resources, as well as we have a really robust environmental education programming. So we host school groups of all ages, adult programming, and different kinds of specialty programmings. And one of the things we were really struggling with is we were trying to do the operations of our education department out of two really kind of antiquated log cabins that had been there since, you know, like the 40s, probably the 30s, 40s, 50s. They didn't meet ADA. You know, the bathrooms weren't really great for the kids. And they also just had really big limitations for how big a school groups we could have. So a lot of times we'll have, you know, a couple buses full of kids come, you know, we could fill up four classrooms. We just didn't have the resources to really be able to do the education programming that our department was wanting to provide and that, you know, we were able to provide to the county.
As a trailhead to the 565-acre preserve, the project marks a point of arrival and departure, where education begins not at the classroom door, but along the paths that weave through the site.
Before, they had a few buildings on site. They had the Welcome Center. And as JT was mentioning, they had these cabins. And these cabins were located in the middle of their most pristine ecosystem, which is a northern flatwood forest. And I actually grew up just a few hours from here. My first job was in Chicago, so I know the landscape quite well. But for many who don't know northern flatwoods, it's actually kind of swampy and it's kind of wet. And you don't think of northern climates as having that like swampiness to it. And so the issue that they were having with these loop trails where you really get immersed in this landscape were not too accessible for everybody. And so they wanted to provide like almost like a trailhead into these flatwoods that everyone could access and everyone could be learning about when you're inside a building, having that nature immediately outside your window, but then also developing a series of loops within this landscape to then go out and learn in the natural environment. We wanted to really kind of pare it down to the essentials, and that was having two classrooms that were inside conditioned space, one classroom that was exterior, a screen porch, and so three classrooms. Typically, when students come to this facility, they come in two buses, and so four classes. And what they do is they set up around the building and in nature and then rotate. And so you'll have one class outside, one class in the screen porch, and the other two inside the building for, you know, learning different things. And then they rotate about every hour or so and do the full sort of immersion that way. And so it was, you know, setting that up along with having a small sort of exhibit space that talked about not only the forest, but also the building itself.
Early in the process, a diverse team of designers, engineers, educators, and forest preserve staff convene to align goals and establish a shared framework for decision making.
This was a project where I think programming ideas about performance and the site were really all inseparable from the start, really focused on engaging that broad group of stakeholders. Like Plato's process on all of our projects is, I think, inherently very collaborative. And I think the goals that the client came to us with really stepped it up a notch from the very start, with really bringing in all of those groups, distilling those goals into it through a process we call our integrated design workshop. So we run this on all of our projects from the start, where we get, you know, facility staff, the landscape architects at the Forest Preserve, who were our client, that was really interesting on this project, other departments, education, Forest Preserve leadership, and then the design team, engineers, interpretive designers, us at Lake Plato. Everyone's in the same room talking about goals for the project and really seeing what those common threads are and setting really clear expectations for what, you know, the process would look like. And so that happened at the very beginning. And I think that really sort of set some different processes in motion that were all in parallel. There was this understanding of the site, which, you know, we worked really closely on with the landscape architects at the Forest Preserve and ecologists. And then there was also how the building would be used, education staff, facility staff. And then there was the performance aspect of the goal of net zero. And so all of those things were really being advanced at the same time. And ultimately, our task was finding how those things were interwoven and complementing each other to really advance all of those things together at the same time. So it was a lot at the front, a very front-loaded process. But once all of that was clear, it actually makes, again, expectations really known. And everyone, I feel like, has a sense of ownership in the project, which is really important.
This was one of the first projects that was a virtual interview after COVID landed. And so, you know, originally the scope was probably about twice the size that it ended up. There was supposed to be 4 classrooms, all conditioned. And we had designed it that way, but with everything that was happening with supply chain issues and the cost of lumber just skyrocketing, we were having to pivot a little later in the game than we usually, because we usually have a good sense for cost on things, but not 5 years ago when all that was happening. And so that was just one thing that happened. The best thing about that period, though, was that it forced everyone to have these programming exercises outside. So we were in the woods talking about these things instead of inside. And I love that. Like, it forced everybody to be outside.
Conceived as a living demonstration of environmental stewardship, the Education Center aligns its mission with performance. Part of this performance aims to achieve an operational net zero building with renewable energy at the forefront.
As a district, you know, we do have like a long vision, right? So we have like a 100-year vision, and we're very forward thinking of how all of our facilities are sort of, you know, work together. We do have what we call, you know, like a list of our facilities, and some of them are forever buildings. And that just means we're going to kind of fully sort of invest in the maintenance of those facilities and assume that we're going to keep those, you know, essentially forever is the way that we will maintain those facilities. So we knew early on that the education facility would be a forever building. And so it was important for us to program, you know, all of it with that regard. And so when we were talking to Matt and JT, they knew that we wanted, you know, this facility to be long lasting. And then they also knew, you know, that we wanted to meet net zero. And so we had talked early on about different strategies to achieve net zero. And we decided to go with FIAS for a few different reasons. But the main reason was that, you know, it really invests in the envelope system of the building. And we thought that that would be the best way to really reduce our energy costs long-term.
This project started from a really, really strong position, again, because the Forest Preserve had really, really clear goals from the start that they came to us with. And I would say the chief goal that really sort of guided a lot of decision-making was this idea to create what they termed a forever building. This is a building that they defined as operationally net zero, and a building that would last for centuries, not just decades in the way that we typically think of buildings today And so we, you know, quickly realized in filtering through that goal of getting to net zero that it was going to be a task of reducing energy demand. And we got there from a couple different angles. The first was just one of our first things we did with a really wonderful MEP engineer, affiliated engineers in Chicago that we worked with. They did a early use inventory of all of their energy use in their existing facilities to really see how they use energy at their welcome center, doing their educational programs, all those things. And that exercise really made it clear that the biggest opportunity was going to be reducing demand instead of just adding renewables. And then also the sort of parallel thing that was advancing was this understanding of the site. And as we realized where the building was going to be located, we realized we were going to be building sort of adjacent to this sensitive forest. And in that location, you have tree cover, you have limited solar exposure, and we really were tasked with keeping the renewables on the roof. And while also creating a very compact footprint because of the sensitive nature of the site. And so it very quickly came into focus that we have to dramatically reduce energy demand in this building, and that the clearest path to doing that was going to be through Passive House certification. This project did receive funding from a really wonderful grant program, the Illinois Clean Energy Community Foundation. It's a mouthful. But they provided a significant source of funding for the project that required a third-party certification. And so Passive FIA certification was one of the paths. And from there, it was really about discipline in the envelope and really, again, capping the demand so that all of the PV could fit on the roof, which ended up being about a 21 kilowatt array that does offset all of the building's energy in a year.
Supported by the Illinois Clean Energy Community Foundation, the FIAS Zero Certified Facility achieves an 80% reduction in energy use compared to a conventional building, embodying the Forest Preserve's broader ambition toward passive house and whole building energy modeling using WOFE Passive.
So passive house is really interesting. It is prioritizing passive strategies to reduce energy demand. And so I think there is this misconception because passive house originated in a cold climate that it only really works in a cold climate, but I think the principles can be applied to any climate. Chicago is a cold place. It is a cold climate. And it has actually a really good path to net zero in that climate. But in principle, you're investing in the envelope to reduce temperature swings in the interior of the building by conserving energy. And so you super insulate, you prioritize air barrier continuity so that you keep the air inside the building. In the winter, you know, when it's 14 degrees outside, most buildings, essentially the interior air just gets sucked out through cracks in the walls because they're not well sealed. In passive house, you literally create a pretty tightly sealed envelope with very little air infiltration. And so that warm air stays inside the building. And so therefore it's subject to far less sort of volatility and temperature swings. And the same is reverse in the summer. You want to keep that cool air that you're conditioning inside. And then that's just the envelope. You're also balancing the location and sizes of your windows. That's a whole intensive exercise using WOFE Passive, which is a German software developed by a scientist that it was not developed by an architect, I can tell you that. But it's very fun and interesting to use, very input data heavy. It's a lot of fun. But it is a very comprehensive understanding of a building that you just don't get to that level, like you're saying, on other buildings. But it is truly engineered from every standpoint. So WOFE Passive is a whole building energy model that if you are going to certify a building with FIAS, and that's the Passive House Institute of the United States, you got to lock that decision in early. I'll say that. I think that was a sort of key success of this project, was that decision was made extremely early in the project. And really from schematic design onward, you are modeling the building at a really intense level of understanding and projecting systems and envelope in WOFE Passive. So you're inputting things, starting with, you know, climate data, operational data, building orientation, envelope assemblies, even if you don't know, you're making suggestions right off the bat about what those things are going to be, the performance of your glazing, thermal bridging coefficients of window frames. So right out the gate, you were having to figure all of that out, because all of it matters a lot. And what that's ultimately telling you is what the internal loads are of your building, how much energy it's demanding in terms of both heating and cooling. And really the goal with Woofy Passive is to passively, through the shape and orientation of your building, reduce those demands as low as you possibly can. And so FIAS has criteria, like a pass-fail criteria, based on your climate zone of what those numbers are. So a building in Chicago that's certifying with FIAS is not going to have the same heat or cooling demand requirements as a building in Austin, Texas. Those will be different benchmarks based on the climate and whether heating is more dominant or cooling is more dominant. So starting that process from the very beginning, that's what you're doing. And then the Woofy model actually has a life of its own that continues through design, through construction, and even to occupancy, where they're using that model as a verification tool and actually taking measured data from the building once it's completed to put it back into the model to confirm that everything is working as it should. So we're very interesting and intensive process. But we all need more constraints. I'm a fan of like constraints. I think it's actually really hard when you walk into a situation and there are endless possibilities. And so walking in and it all being on the same page as a team and saying, we're going to go for Passive House certification, that implicitly meant certain things about the building, how it was going to be occupied, what it was going to look like, certainly the envelope. And so, yeah, just embracing those constraints and actually using them as a teaching tool, which, you know, filters into a lot more of the story of this building.
It was a lot easier, kind of, once we knew that it was going to be Passive House, because everyone got on board and it was like, okay, there's no turning back. Every decision from now on has to be a certain way. And all the way down to when we were interviewing contractors, you know, we went with one that had done Passive House before. And so it was kind of liberating in a way. I mean, it was complex. It was hard. Don't get me wrong. But as far as decision-making process, it was a little bit easier.
Lake Flato engaged with the landscape architects at Lake County Forest Preserves on every level, taking all aspects of the surrounding ecology into account, particularly regarding the site.
With all of our projects, we kind of start with the lens of preserve, enhance, and transform. And those three things in that order. Number one, if we're working in a pristine environment, you have to be hyper aware of everything that needs to be preserved that you can't mess up. That's number one. Number two is enhance. And enhance is something that you can do in a very, very small way that will lead to a huge outcome. So little effort, huge reward. That's second. And then the third is, if you do have to transform the site, how to do that in a healing way, meaning you build on areas of the landscape that are the most disturbed. And so with those three in mind, we first started with the site to say, oh, well, we want to preserve these cabins that are here and we want to preserve the flatwoods. So let's build next to the Welcome Center, which is actually across a road and kind of not in, in a more agricultural landscape, for lack of a better term. And we went back and forth with the client on that and really kind of came to the conclusion that to really speak specifically from an educational standpoint of the flatwoods, the building needs to be within that landscape. And so once we decided that, we kind of did a hard look on the cabins, and we're all for preserving buildings, but it just really, once we went in there, we realized the extent of those, and they were on its last legs. So then we said, okay, well, let's then to heal this part of the site, let's build on it and create some surrounding landscape that would then mesh into the Flatwoods Forest. And so that was second. And then I guess lastly, and JT picked up on it a little bit earlier, but Lake Flato's process is to listen to the land first and listen to people who know the land. And so we jump in the back seat and let the ecologists drive, let the biologists, let the landscape architects teach us about the landscape. And, you know, coincidentally, the client was, they are the landscape architects. And so It was really interesting in starting to design it because we start to spitball ideas and shapes and forms. And usually that's done behind a curtain, right? And then we kind of come up with a cohesive design, but that was being done with the client in the same room. And so that was at first a little getting used to, but it was fun and it was great. And it created buy-in on the design pretty quickly.
In general, the placing of the building was, again, a whole collaborative process that was shaped by the site, the sort of process of listening to the land, working with the landscape architects at the Forest Preserve. As Matt said, the building was ultimately positioned on the site of those existing cabins, which were actually removed and relocated somewhere else. But really looking at that perimeter of disturbed area adjacent to the floodplains that do kind of creep up pretty close to this area of the site. So we very carefully mapped, again, with the ecologists and landscape architects at the Forest Preserve, the lines of the 500-year floodplain and 100-year, but use the 500-year as our real boundary. And also identifying some of the sensitive plants species in those zones and creating sort of go, no-go zones on the site plan. This is because of the sort of northern flatwood forest ecosystem. There are some endangered plants and amphibians that are really important to this environment. So understanding that ecology, and then really in the immediate context of the building, it was two really large heritage oak trees that we've spent some time carefully mapping with an arborist to understand the root and canopy zones. And really, at the end of the day, we were, by like fractional degrees, positioning the building in between those trees to really make sure that we were staying out of their root zones while also considering the solar exposure on the roof for the PV. And it was this sort of like multiple dials we were all turning at one time and positioning the building just perfectly to sort of seeing with the landscape and those trees while also meeting the performance goals. So the result is, I think, is that the building feels like it just belongs there. It couldn't have gone anywhere else.
It was almost a catch-22 with those trees because we had to model not only, where it landed on the ground, where the trunk landed, but also the canopy, because that great shade that you can sit under outside would also shade the solar. And so the renewables wouldn't function as well. And so that was the trick. How do you nestle up against these trees to provide those great experiences, but also allow sun to hit your solar panels? So it was a lot of nudging.
Accessibility also required careful considerations and transformational methods to ease navigation and flow throughout the flatwoods.
They had made some attempts over the years with boardwalks, and really that was the first clue when we walked out of the site, or where are the boardwalks located? Because those are areas that were more swampy than others. And it can trick you. That landscape can trick you. It can be totally dry when you walk through and then be wet and stay wet for a long time after a rain or when you have snow melt. So that was kind of the first clue of the loop. But those were, not built to ADA standards. Some of them were in need of replacement. And we developed working with the Forest Preserve, a new route that really kind of meandered in and out, mostly out of the floodplains, where before I think they just barreled right into them. And so that strategy was an interesting process.
Yeah, the result of that trail, I'll just add, was I think a really amazing part of this project is that from the location of the bus drop-off on the road to the building and then through this loop in the forest, that entire route is completely accessible, which I think is really transformational for their programs. And it was definitely not the case beforehand.
So is it still boardwalks or did you use a different material to make these easier to navigate?
It's a different material. Yeah, we have some boardwalk type structures really close to the building, some ramps coming in and out, but the trail itself is a paved trail.
In addition to an all-wood exterior and robust cellulose insulation in the walls and roof, a triple-pane bird-friendly glass system was integrated and designed with cooperation from several partners.
So this is an all-wood building. There is no steel or metal framing. It's all-wood construction. We're building in Chicago, so there is a concrete frost wall foundation. But from the beginning, again, we knew we were going to really have to focus on super insulating this whole thing. And so pretty quickly dialed in what that meant in terms of our values. And so the slab foundation is R55. It has about 12 inches of foam under the concrete slab, in addition to 6 inches of foam on the outside of the frost wall, that with a thermally broken connection between the slab and the frost wall. And then going up the building into the wall assembly, it's 2x8 wood studs that are infilled with blown cellulose insulation. And then there's additional 6 inches of mineral wool outside of that. So that comes out to about R49 wall. And then the roof, this was really fun, is about 30 inches of blown cellulose. So these are prefabricated wood trusses. So you're basically building a huge cellulose insulation cavity, and they just blow all that full with the cellulose. So that's an R99 roof. And it's really interesting thinking about, you know, how kind of incredible that sounds in the context of many buildings. But with, I think the really interesting thing about this project is it's a public building, but it's also a very small building. And with Passive House, it's really interesting to see how some of those energy demand standards translate to really what the envelope ends up being based on how big or small the building is. Our contractor who we worked with in this project is really wonderful, had done some Passive House projects, but they were 30,000 square foot buildings and had a very different envelope system with much lower R values, because really the ratio of the interior air volume to the surface area of the envelope is super different in that scenario. And so this, even though it's a public building, we really had to build it kind of like a house, like at the scale of a residential project in terms of the robustness of these assemblies. And that's really what it required in terms, just because of the compact nature of the footprint, again, balanced by the constraints of the site. Also the desire to have this building open up to the landscape and not just be this box, but really to feel connected to the forest around it. So that's just the envelope. And then within the envelope, the windows and doors, huge point of coordination and technical sort of delivery on this project. We have triple pane glass that is also integrally bird friendly. This was the first project in North America certified with FIAS to do this, to use integrally bird friendly glass within a triple paned window system, thermally broken window system. It's a mouthful, a lot going on. But engineering that whole system, this was working with Schüco windows, which come from Germany, and Ornolux Mikado glass, which is the glass that has a UV frit on it that, you know, birds can see, but we cannot. So that was integrated into this window assembly. And those came from Germany and were assembled. Different components were actually coming from Turkey as well, and those came over to Chicago. But it was really interesting. Actually, Matt, why don't you tell this little anecdote about that?
Well, I think it's great. I remember JT calling me up and telling me the story. And basically, we're going to Germany for both our Ornolux, our bird-friendly glass, and the triple pane window. And it's, their factories were only, 20 miles away from each other in Germany. And this is the first time they had worked together. And so a project in Chicago, Illinois, United States of America, was the first to bring two German companies together that are in very close proximity to work cohesively on a project. And so that's something I love, because we made that connection, and hopefully they can, you know, continue that relationship on for projects over there.
This landscape at Ryerson, they've documented over 200 different bird species just at this forest preserve. It's a really important habitat for both birds that live there all year round, but also that migrate. And so our firm, like Flato, we've actually been doing a lot more research about this and are integrating bird-friendly glass into most of our projects now. But it's really actually, you could have this, I guess, scenario on any building where, particularly when you're seeing through glass and beyond, there's additional glass. So at a building corner, say both you have two pieces of glass coming together and a bird can see through it. No matter the scale of the building, that's a big issue. And that is a really high rate of bird strikes coming from that condition. And so it's really, yeah, anytime you can see sort of be like through two windows beyond, birds cannot really perceive. You know, that's when you'll get a bird strike. And so in this environment, that was super, super important.
I remember the first time I was on site, and we went into one of their buildings, and there was a bird kill at the door. And that was walking into the building, that was the experience of seeing that kind of set the tone. That cannot happen at this new building. And they were completely on board with that.
Materially, The roof and walls fall in line with the project's goals to maximize renewable performance and durability.
So the material choices for the exterior and interior were very much informed by that concept of a forever building. And so build, you know, materials that were going to be super durable, very low maintenance, and were recyclable or came from recyclable, you know, other recycled materials. And so the roof and some of the walls are zinc. So zinc is fully recyclable, you know, very long lifespan, really beautiful too, just really lovely natural material. And then the other exterior material is a poly ash siding, which comes from byproducts used in making cement. So they're taking all the waste product from that process and pressing it into a board, similar to a hardy board, but it's a little bit of a different product. And so those are the primary exterior materials. And then as much foam-free insulation as we possibly could. So the only foam insulation is really below grade in this project.
The resulting interior is both precise and inviting. Daylit classrooms open toward the landscape, while a screened outdoor learning space creates a porous edge between inside and out.
This is, again, an intentionally pretty efficient and compact little building. It really is those two classrooms that are anchoring the program, one on each end. The building's sort of shaped like a T. And so the top two kind of ends of the T are the indoor classrooms, and the bottom part is that screened-in porch. And then in between at the intersection of those things is an entry vestibule, which is an important thing in this climate of sort of tempering, you know, the movement of in and out of a building in terms of conditioning. And in that entry vestibule is where the energy dashboard for this building lives. And then beyond that is a sort of interpretive corridor where you'll find access to the restrooms and small office, and then a room that holds the equipment for the rainwater harvesting system that is used to flush the toilets in the building. So that's it. It's a pretty intentionally compact building. It's really a building you come to leave, to go outside and to be in the forest. So it's a trailhead in that way.
I'm surprised there's no even like small kitchen or, yeah, the first thing I think of is like going to outdoor school when I was a kid, or, you know, kids, you know, bringing lunches and needing a microwave, or for somebody working there, is there anything at all for that kind of thing, or they just plan for it?
That's phase two.
That is
phase two. Yeah, there is a kitchen. Something really interesting that happens at this preserve is maple syrup harvesting demonstrations. And so within that expansion, which we actually did, you know, design fully as an additional building to the south of this one, there's a kitchen that supports that program. And yeah, exactly what you're saying in terms of staff and things like that.
You know, typically architects and, you know, modern architects like to have glazing that's floor to ceiling. But in looking at this section and realizing that there's 30 inches of this insulation on this roof, it almost made it seem like the windows, if you were designing a certain way, the first or second passes of it, the windows were down low. And then we had this big sort of forehead, like layer cake around where you couldn't put any windows. And so it looked, just the proportions looked very odd, just because that's what we had to do. And so I think what we did to solve that and create great daylight is we have two dormers that popped up out of the roof in the two classrooms that were able to balance the light, but also bring that glazing up on that level of, and just kind of solve some of those, the weird proportion. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And what, building on what Matt said, I think daylight maybe was where we started in terms of a material, if that's, you know, sounds kind of weird, but it really, the interior experience of being in this building was really shaped by connecting with the outside, with the forest beyond, and the way that light, you know, is coming into the room through that dormer, through the larger windows where, you know, students are actually walking directly out of the classroom onto that interpretive trail straight, you know, right outside. And then through the rest of the space, being very intentionally restrained and really, you know, inviting warmth and simplicity. You know, so the floors are polished concrete. It's the structural slab. The walls are just, some are gypsum board, but a lot of them are actually white oak. So the white oak walls and the white oak on the ceilings is actually from trees that were culled from the surrounding forest preserve that were dead or already fallen. And so the forest preserve went and collected all of that and milled it into wood that they then used, you know, to clad most of the interior. So really the aesthetic is derived from the forest and the place itself, about connecting to the forest beyond.
Through biomimetic storytelling, drawing parallels between natural systems like acorns, beaver lodges, and bird feathers, visitors encounter concepts such as insulation, airtightness, and thermal performance in ways that feel intuitive and tangible.
It comes from this, I think, very early recognition that the concepts sort of surrounding passive house can be very technically complex, but this is a building that's ultimately about educating, you know, fourth graders. And so it's a question we were asking ourselves as a team from the start of how do we really translate some of these really wonderful stories into a way that a fourth grader could understand? And so from that point, we had a really wonderful interpretive designer on our team, EDX Exhibits, who's in Seattle. We worked with them on a couple other projects and did some really wonderful early workshops between them and the educator staff at the Forest Preserve to really learn how are they teaching their programs? What are they already using as sort of like metaphors to explain, you know, the built environment, natural systems? And they were the ones that brought the richness and these, how did we tell these stories moving forward in different places in the building? So, for example, one of the educators, we were kind of explaining to them what an air barrier was in a passive house building. And they were like, oh, so that's like an acorn. And we were like, do tell, explain that to us, please. And they said, well, an acorn needs an air barrier in order to germinate. It has to stay airtight and dry. And we were like, that's amazing. So, you know, what an incredible way to explain that concept to a fourth grader. Similarly, triple pane glass works because bird feathers work in the same way. They trap layers of air between the feathers, and that's the exact same way that triple pane glass works. And beaver lodges are just super insulated little buildings that they build because that works. It's passive design. And so taking those stories, integrating them into those elements in the building, I think there's a lot of richness found there that really, you know, ties the stories of performance and place together in a really compelling way. And then on top of that, there's the energy dashboard, again, which is at the kind of front door of the building that actually displays the real-time energy use and power generation of the building. So that was a really interesting process of getting that up and running, and sort of a technical feat of getting all those things to talk to each other in terms of the sub-metering and breaking it down and, again, making it translatable in a way that anyone could understand. So it's another really, I think, wonderful part of this project.
The building's energy efficiency and robust thermal performance are deeply intertwined with its MEP systems, which reinforce and extend the rigor of its passive house design.
I think the really interesting thing about a FES building is that because the envelope is doing so much heavy lifting, your mechanical systems get simpler and smaller. And so I think, you know, it's really nothing too complex in terms of heating and cooling. It's an air source heat pump. There's a heat pump, hot water heater. There is that rainwater collection system that's sort of standalone that is how the toilets, you know, are flushed in the building. But I would say the heart of the building, which is becoming more common, but definitely very much a central aspect of passive house, is the energy recovery ventilator. So this is our ERV for short. So what that's doing is because, you know, passive house buildings are so airtight, you don't get that air just naturally flowing in and out of through the cracks of the walls. And so you have to mechanically deliver fresh air into the spaces that are inhabited by people. And so that ERV is really interesting because it is constantly turning over the air volume of the building and actually taking the heat from the exhaust air. Let's say this is winter and it's 14 degrees outside. You're exhausting air about maybe 68 degrees. It's taking the heat from that air and transferring it to the incoming cold air at an efficiency rate of 88% in this building. So you're taking the heat energy without mixing the air streams, essentially, and preheating the incoming air. And the same reverse is true in the summer. You're taking the cool outgoing air and transferring that energy to the incoming hot air. So I think that's a really unique aspect of pretty much all passive house buildings, and is a really incredible piece of mechanical equipment that we're going to be seeing a lot more of. we say this kind of tongue in cheek, but it's also sort of true. You could heat this building with a hairdryer, you know, for a good bit of the winter. And, you know, there are Arctic blasts that would, you know, make that be an exception, but you really could. And it's that investment, you see that return through your operational energy savings. So there's a really powerful story for this building. I've heard this term before. It's not my term, but it's one that I think makes a lot of sense and is something to aspire to for any project like this. It's called the lock-in effect. And what that means is you're putting that investment in the envelope, but because that is a passive investment, that you're going to see the compounding interest, you know, from the benefit of that over time. And so for this building in particular, we're able to project that that initial investment in the envelope is going to be fully offset within 11 years based on how reduced the utility bills are. And then within 100 years, this building will save over $1.2 million in energy costs.
Maintaining the site's integrity and understanding the interconnectedness of the building to the surrounding environment posed the most challenging design hurdles.
And for me, and I kind of mentioned it before, it was really working in a landscape that's pristine and making sure that you don't cause harm to it. It's the building is all about educating people about that landscape. And that's the biggest nervousness I always have on projects like this, is that we somehow will leave the landscape more in worse shape than when we showed up. And so, and again, that's why we, you know, double and triple down on making sure from an ecological standpoint that we're checking all the boxes prior to drawing any placement for the building or any design of the building.
My answer, I think, is very much similar to that. I think this project was just everything was important. You know, there was nothing that wasn't insignificant. The site demanded that, the performance goals demanded that, and really marrying those two things together. Specifically, what's in my mind is just making sure we had the PV array sized appropriately, because I mean, we were having our MEP engineer 3D model the actual measurements of these tree canopies, like trying to project, you know, what the loss of efficiency was going to be from different seasonal shading, and just a whole new level of, like, even, you know, how much snow could we get at a time that's covering these panels, and really taking into account these really sort of micro variables that I think cumulatively all are super important. And so it was like really negotiating all of these tiny things. There wasn't one big thing. It was just, you know, cranking those dials, understanding every facet, which was super fun, but also challenging to get to that depth of understanding about all of it.
The construction phase supplied no shortage of obstacles to overcome, from navigating pandemic-era supply chain issues to coordinating translated drawings from Germany and recalibrating the siding installation to align with the framing system.
COVID. Yeah, COVID was hard. This building started construction in 2022. I feel like that was when sort of the after effects of COVID were starting to clarify. I remember while this project was being bid, it was that exact scenario that we talked about earlier, where it was like suddenly 2 weeks later, something doubled, you know, and there was no explanation for it. Supply chain issues were a big one. So like random electrical components were being told, it'll be 3 years and we need it, you know, in 3 months. Working around those types of things, which ultimately on a passive house project, really the biggest concern was about sequencing of trades, because certain, what something was behind, well, because of the air barrier continuity, you can't put that in until this other thing is in. And it was sort of negotiating those conversations, staying super involved in those conversations between different subcontractors. I think it was just another level of depth of involvement that I have not been involved in because of some of those conversations. So
for me, and this goes along with JT, something kind of crazy that happened was we were reviewing the window and door submittals from Germany. Number one, it was written in German, right? Number two, what we realized was that all of the door swings were on the submittal were backwards. And so that caught our eye right away, and we corrected those. Well, coincidentally enough, how long did those take to ship over, JT? 4 months or something? I don't know. And we got them on site and they said, all the doors swings are backwards. They're opening up the exact opposite way. And we said, no, we corrected that in the shop drawings. And then what we realized is that in Germany, they draw their symbol the exact reverse of how we do it in the United States. And so they had it right, but we had reversed it to where the symbol is a US symbol of how the door swing opens. And coincidentally enough, there we had a woman on our team that hadn't caught it because the only firm she had worked with was actually in Europe, the Netherlands. And so she thought that's actually the right way. So she was used to a European symbol and there was no going back at that point. We could not send it back. That was a change.
Thankfully, it all worked out. It wasn't that big of a deal. And there was one occasion we were like, actually, that may make more sense. So it ended up being okay.
And I'm left-handed, so you know, if I grab a door differently than somebody else, it might be more natural for us lefties.
One of the biggest challenges was really that the way that Lake Flato had initially assumed that the siding was going to get attached to the building didn't really, you know, work once we got the contractor involved for reasons that are a little bit, you know, beyond me. But they had anticipated, you know, that the siding would be able to be kind of like through bolted back into the framing. And the contractor was basically like, you know, we really can't do that. It's not going to work. There's no way for us to basically blindly, you know, secure because it's like a 16-inch wall section. So they're like, you know, it's like at 12 to 14-inch anchor, you know, all the way back through. Like there's almost zero chance we're going to be able to hit the frame boards. So that was a challenge. We ended up having to build like a lattice work within the existing framing. So basically, you know, like a 16-inch grid both directions so that we had enough attachment points, you know, to anchor the siding onto it. For the zinc siding too, we had to add plywood. So I think because of the wall thickness, just having enough attachment points so that it's easier for the trades was a big change for us in the middle of construction.
For Matt and JT, looking at the project from the perspective of their peers and partners to achieve their goals proved invaluable.
There was so much richness found in the process of working with the educators at the Forest Preserve and our interpretive designer and really telling the story of Passive House at Net Zero in a way that isn't over intellectualized. It's really understandable and really tying that back to the place in a really powerful way. So I think it really opened my mind to see that net zero and performance and all these things are like so important, but it's so much more powerful and impactful when it's legible to people and that story is really told. And that's, yeah, where you have potential for a lot of impact. So I think moving forward, it's like, I think about every project, how can we tell this story? How is this going to be visible, you know? Sort of thinking about architecture in that way as a teaching tool, carry that forward.
Knowing when to step aside and when to have other people lead. And I talked about it in a landscape perspective, but also just working internally at Lake Flato with JT, he has skill sets that I will never have. And so he was a perfect fit for this project. And just, you know, we have a lot of talented people at the firm and just allowing them to drive.
The Ryerson Woods Education Center is designed to endure both physically and culturally. It supports a wide range of programs, strengthens community ties to the preserve, and exemplifies how thoughtful design can yield lasting environmental, social, and economic value. Rooted in its setting and guided by purpose, it represents as a model of what a public building can be, not only efficient and resilient, but meaningful enough to be cared for and sustained over time. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Matt and JT thought we need to be doing to level up in the sustainability arena.
For me, I'd like to see and this is not a dig on landscape profession, but I'd really like to see more certifications from a landscape-based perspective. We have sustainable sites, which was great. Lake Flato, we were part of a pilot program for that with that same rewilding project I was telling you about with Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, co-authored sustainable sites at the time. But I'd love to see, I mean, what does FIAS look like in with the landscape? What does living building look like in living landscape? What is like that for me? I would just love to sit next to a landscape architect who is pursuing that next level of certification that's more based on the natural environment.
Yeah, to echo what Matt said, really, you know, regenerative design being a sort of new benchmark of not just doing harm, but being participatory in the restoration of land and systems. And I think also, you know, it's interesting to think about Ryerson, this project as something very exceptional, but I think it's sort of moving, what would be amazing to see is just moving, you know, towards that becoming more of like the baseline expectation, especially for public projects, buildings that are public facing and using funds from the public. You know, I feel like we do know how to do these things in terms of designing high performance envelopes, fully electrifying buildings. It's really about scaling that, and also as architects being advocates. And I love the conversation about just framing the way we talk about these things as advantageous for our clients in a financial sense. That is our job, you know, as architects to steward those conversations. I think we're learning a lot about that, even just in how we talk about these things. And I think we're still learning a lot, but I would, yeah, love to see something like this just be like, yep, that's what we do. Just because that's what we should do.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Matt and JT. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I think for me, it all ties together. It's seeing, you know, this opportunity to help people reconnect and understand the natural systems in the world that support all of us and change how we live over time, accepting that we have a responsibility, you know, to care for these things that we're deeply connected to and depend on us as stewards. So I think it's, if I could just have some role in shifting people's perspective or behavior towards that, I think that'd be great.
We actually talk about this quite a bit at the firm, and we talk about it in terms of how can we create the biggest impact. And while we love buildings, we love architecture, the biggest impact we can have is when you inspire the next generation of architects and planners, but also the next generation of environmental stewards in any shape, fashion, or form. And so I think JT and I are lucky enough to work in our eco-conservation studio where the driver is these educational facilities that speak to the landscape. And so for me, I love, after the building's completed, just watching those kids go through the building, point at something, scream, yell, like just kind of realize for the first time many times kind of that connection. And so, yeah, that'll always be my answer.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening, we'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.